spirit within, and all we are and all we do is a blessing to the world. I am the heart, I am the hands, I am the voice of spirit on earth, and all I am and all I do is a blessing to the world, blessing to the
invite you to just, if you're not already, allow your eyes to close, settle in, and just take a few nice deep breaths. Just connect into the awareness of breathing in and breathing out. Allowing your body to be quiet, to slow down. And then allowing your awareness to drop inside to your heart, to your body, any feelings, sensations, maybe to your mind, any thoughts and feelings. This morning's going to be an invitation to use your imagination. So in this spirit of meditation, I'd like to offer a few words from today's daily word about reframing with imagination. Reframing is a technique through which we change a negative perception into something more positive and constructive. In the face of life's difficulties, our first reaction is often to imagine the negative side of the situation, perhaps with the excuse that if we anticipate worst-case scenarios, we can prevent them. We tell ourselves it's just in case. We don't realize that, instead of preventing, we are using the power of our thoughts and feelings to create a story of limitation and scarcity. In such moments, it is time to pause and remember that the presence of God is in everything, including any challenge or difficulty we may be experiencing. Not all reframes are lighthearted, but they allow us to face any situation with openness, recognizing that every challenge is temporary. By opening ourselves to possibilities, we remember that we always have God with us in whatever we are living through. So I just invite you in these moments of quiet. Is there a situation that you've labeled a challenge, an annoyance, or a problem? Can you observe those facts objectively, just as they are? And are you able to pay attention to the story you're building around those facts? Maybe asking yourself, is what I'm thinking real, or is it assumption? And am I willing to see it in a different way? If the answer is yes, you are ready to reframe by using the power of your imagination. So just allowing yourself to be grateful, to be open, to be compassionate, and to be curious with however you are arriving today. And then just taking a few nice, deep breaths and allowing your awareness to come back to the room. And as you feel ready, opening your eyes. Thank you, Julie, Rita, and R. And Jim, oh, Jim, thank you, Jim. I forgot, Jim, ever since you told me about that at Fat Follies, our proneness to forget, you know, I'm just like, yeah, there we go. But anyway, that song is a reframe. What if everything you did, everything you were, everything you are, is a blessing? What would shift? Cool stuff. So today is March 15th. In the Christian calendar, this is the season of Lent. And we have this Sunday, the next Sunday, the Sunday after that is Palm Sunday, the awesome service we're going to have for that, and then April 5th is Easter Sunday. Does anybody just geeking out on stuff like this know how the day of Easter Sunday is determined? Oh, Tammy? Okay, I see that hand. Yes, how is it? There you go. The first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring or vernal equinox. Yes, yes. So, just fascinating how churches conflate astrology and all this stuff. It's just great. But I think it's just important for us to just set, you know, today in context, because, you know, we have our calendars that we operate by, but I do think there are astrological, spiritual, energetic calendars that also have an influence on us. And, you know, this season of Lent, if you grew up with Lent as I did as a Catholic, you know, you give up something for Lent, chocolate, television, exercise. You know, I'm not going to do that. Okay, you know, and again, that's without, you know, for some people that's very helpful and very useful. But you know, Lent is this 40-day experience up until the resurrection of Christ, which is about life in the desert. And if any of you have ever been in deserts or close to deserts, you know, they're just, you know, not maybe the most favorite place to go. But I think all of us can say that we go through periods of our life where we find ourselves in a spiritual desert. And in the barrenness and in the aridness and in the apparent lifelessness of the desert, there are jewels to be found spiritually. Spiritual growth and spiritual progress as we progress through life comes more by subtraction than it does addition. Things are taken from us and we learn to find ourselves and find love and find God again. So I've titled this series of messages leading up to Easter, Beginning Again. And today, particularly, we're going to think about it as coming home to love. Coming home to love. That's the spiritual journey. Doug? But you only have today. Indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There's a lot we could say about that, too. But, you know, at the end of the day, my friends, I really believe that what we're doing is holding each other's hands and walking each other home. All of our rituals, all of our practices, all of our experiences are in the service of that. And so I want to begin by just setting the intention for today's message. May we realize the collective effervescence that we already are. Just let your mind marinate in collective effervescence. I got that term on Friday. I'm shamelessly stealing it from Reverend Dennis Ashley. We had a lively conversation. It was just wonderful. Earlier this week, I met Reverend Jeff Tawney of Unity North Spokane, another amazing individual. And I think you guys also know that Steve Tolles is my Unity mentor as I go through the process of doing all of that. And just the opportunity to interact with these individuals has just been so rich. But we got talking about this idea of collective effervescence. And I just love that because for me, when I think of effervescence, it just evokes all kinds of shapes, colors, temperatures, movements, you know, in this collective soup of love. And I think that's beautiful. And again, the reality is that we already are that. You see? And so with that knowledge, can we shift our consciousness of our lives now from default to design? Can we shift our consciousness from default to design? Default consciousness is kind of a victim consciousness that says, well, this is just how life's happened to me, and I guess I got to just play the cards I've dealt. I don't know if you've ever been there, but I go there a lot. In fact, that's my default way of thinking, is thinking that life is just kind of the way it is. But what if we shifted and asked ourselves, what kind of life do I want to design? What do I want to look at with my life that I have, this place that I have, and design it consciously? There's days I still wake up and I think it's crazy. How have I landed here in North Idaho? You know, the circumstances and the things that brought me here are just crazy, you know? And yet, when I shift my consciousness to what do I want to design, oh my gosh, possibilities. Imagination just goes nuts. So if you just hear that today will be a success. Everything else I'm going to share is just going to be reflections around it, but if you can walk out of here today knowing that we here and this whole town, this whole planet, this whole universe is a collective effervescence of love, and ask yourself as you leave here today, how do I want to design my life? What is the life that I want to create? Today will be a success. So with that, let's imagine this. God's love knows no limits, conditions, or bounds. Do you believe that? God's love knows no conditions, limits, or bounds. Therefore, I said this last week, you and I cannot become what we already are. And what we already are is accepted, chosen, and loved. The spiritual path is not a path of earning. It's not a path of accumulating. It's not a path of gaining. It's not a path necessarily of ascent or transcendence, but it's coming home to accepting and receiving that we are fully accepted, chosen, and loved. Beautiful, isn't it? And yet, how many of you would agree that sometimes life is hard? Yeah. How could something so beautiful, so true, be so painful? Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone to enter the kingdom of God. He said the way of life is narrow and wide is the gate that leads to destruction. How does that jive with this idea that everything is good and everything is beautiful and that we already are? Again, I want you to just come back to, again, using the power of your imagination and things that are maybe going on in your life that might just seem absurd and crazy. What if this is all about a part of coming back to the love that you and I already are? So I want to share with you a passage from the scriptures, the Bible. Just a little Bible context here. There are four Gospels in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mark is the one that was written first, and then the other ones came later. So what I like about Mark is that his telling of some of the stories that are told elsewhere are a little bit more raw than in some of the others. They're a little less refined. But this is a passage maybe you've heard before from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 12. It says, "One of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that Jesus had answered them well, asked Jesus, 'Which commandment is the most important of all?' Jesus answered, 'The most important is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these.' And the scribe said to him, 'You are right, teacher.'" There's one of those in every crowd, isn't there? "Thank you, teacher. Yes, you have answered well. You have truly said that God is one, there is no other besides him, and to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." And when Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And no one dared ask him any more questions. I was with some folks last night, and one of the people were telling me, you know, that someone came up and asked them if they're a Christian. I said, "Isn't that such an interesting question?" You know, Jesus never used the word. The term Christian came on the scene. It was really invented by the Romans to identify followers of the early Christ movement. They kind of labeled them that way. But just note that. And secondly, you know, this idea that Jesus came to set up this thing called Christianity. Jesus had this weird way of driving crowds away. He drew crowds and he opened his mouth and started to talk and they all left. You know, it doesn't sound to me like someone wanting to start a movement. The other thing I'd like to say is, when he was asked the greatest commandment, did you notice what was curiously missing from Jesus' answer about the greatest commandment? Any beliefs about him. You see, history has shifted and turned this thing called Christianity into a bunch of things that you got to believe about Jesus and who he lived. Jesus had nothing to do with it. It was never about him. It was all about a way. And this way of loving God, loving the divine with all the heart, mind, soul, and strength, and then this interplay of loving your neighbor as yourself. So I want to just reflect a little bit on part of this thing. And just take a moment as you think about loving God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Which one would you say comes the most easy for you? And which one becomes the most challenging? There's no right or wrong answer, But as you think of these dimensions of loving the divine, loving sacred, loving love, we could even say, which is the most resonant and which is the most, or the most easy and the most difficult? I'll just tell you, for me, loving God with all my mind is a piece of cake. I can think my way in and through anything. My mind can just, yeah, and wax on brilliantly of things. Loving God with all my heart is a challenge. And it's a challenge because my mind is conditioned to manage my heart. And this is important for those of us who come into science of mind and mind, all this kind of stuff, to understand the proper relationship between the mind and the heart. I believe, and my observation has been, is when our mind tries to manage the heart, it leads to all kinds of mental disturbances, anxiety, depression, bipolar, I mean, you name it, okay? If we can understand that the heart can inform the mind can open to new possibilities. We call it science of mind, yes, fittingly and properly so, aware that our mind can create a new reality. But I think sometimes the mind tries to impose itself upon the heart, and the heart is screaming, no, no, no. Why is that? If we were to take a cross-section of our brain, towards the center of our brain would be a little organ called the amygdala. Okay? The amygdala is part of our central brain. It's our most primitive brain. We call it our reptilian brain, or the least evolved part of our brain. It's the seat of intense emotion. It's not the seat of language, but it's the seat of the brain's primary function, was to keep us alive. And when the amygdala is threatened, it releases all kinds of neurochemicals in the mind to protect us, typically adrenaline and cortisol. It puts us in a fight, flight, freeze, or fawn response. Now, that reptilian part of our brain works very, very well to keep us alive, but it hasn't evolved to perceive a real threat or an actual threat. Think of it this way. Have you ever had an experience of watching a sunset or listening to a symphony? I think there was a symphony concert yesterday, right? And just being able to just take it all in. Yesterday I was up in the mountains, had a view of Lake Pendere, and it's just beautiful. You're there, you're present, taking it all in. But then what happens if the fire alarm goes off? Or a bear approaches?
Time to go.
Okay, what does the mind do? Shunk! Hyper focuses on that thing, you lose all awareness of what's going on around you, and you're committed to your protection. Okay? In this experience of loving God with all our heart, with all our mind, with all our soul, and with all our strength, and loving our neighbor as ourself, Rumi says your task is not to search for love, but to search for the walls that you've put around it. And so this experience of protection can build an illusion of separation that causes us to think that we're disconnected somehow from love, disconnected from ourselves, or disconnected from each other. So the invitation here to love God with all the heart, with all the mind, with all the soul. When I think of soul, I think of it really as our essence, our being, who we are, for me, that comes easy, and I think for all of us, it comes rather naturally, because that soul is our part of us that is beyond our human experience, and that essence and sense of who we are. And then loving God with all your strength. When I think of strength, I think of the quality of resilience. Resilience, staying in the game. We're going to fall down. We're going to fail. We're going to mess things up, but get back in the game. Think of the saying, the greatest success in life is not in never failing, but in rising every time you fall. So that's the invitation. That's the path. So what is it that gets in the way? What is it that trips us up? I want to offer something today that I hope will be helpful for you in your experience. What if God's love is a jealous love? Did any of you grow up with that? How does that word jealous land when you hear it? Not very well. No. Not very well. I grew up with that. And it says in the Hebrew scriptures that God's love is a jealous God. And I equated that with an angry God, a possessive God, who ordered the killing of races of people. And he was this angry man with a white beard sitting up in heaven ready to zap people, you know, jealousy. Yeah. When I met Reverend Dennis Ashley on Friday for coffee, I sat down and I was a little nervous, and I said, I'm really excited to meet you, and I'm a little scared to meet you because you are dearly loved at Unity, and not a day goes by when Reverend Dennis used to do this, and Reverend Dennis used to do that, and Reverend Dennis used to do that, you know, and I would just go like, is he better than me, you know? Oh, I don't know. And he just laughed, and he said, I feel the same way. I hear so much about Reverend James this and Reverend James that. Do we do that? And I'll tell you something. It's a little thing. You laugh. But in the moment we connected over that, my body softened. Aww. It relaxed. And it opened. Why? Because in that case, my insecurity, my jealousy towards this man was met with love and laughter. We just laughed. We connected. That softening, that opening, includes the dropping of all the walls and all the masks. I invite you to, if you haven't gone back and listened to my messages the last couple of weeks, talking about the shadow. Our shadow, those parts of us that we refuse to see about ourselves and we refuse to let others see. Why? Because we're scared. So what do? We armor up. We mask up. Pastors and ministers are notorious for it. Why do you think there's so many denominations out there? Whose church is bigger? Whose church has more programs? Whose church has a nicer building? Whose church has a better location? Whose church has better doctrine and spirituality? Yeah, this stuff is real. But my friends, when we can connect on our human honesty, yeah. Jealousy is a tough word, but I learned this week that in Latin cultures, there's a saying that says, if you're not jealous, you don't love. If you're not jealous, you don't love. In egalitarian cultures like ours, jealousy has a very different experience. Author Esther Perel says that eradicating jealousy has come with eradicating patriarchy. It goes against possessiveness, and we pride ourselves in not being jealous. So I just got thinking and wondering, is jealousy a universal human experience? I talked to two people this week when I asked them that question, and before I could even get it out of my mouth, oh, I'm not jealous. Oh, I'm not jealous. I'm not jealous. And then in the next breath, they told me experiences of jealousy and how they processed it. And I had to stop both of them and I say, okay, wait a minute. I'm impressed with how quickly you metabolize jealousy. I'm a little jealous of your ability to do that. But you had an experience, didn't you? Yeah, yeah. And the reason I say this is to think of jealousy being an aspect of love, an aspect of the divine. I'm telling you, it's currently shifting my view of this. I would have not said this is the case. But lately, what if jealousy is not a wall, but a portal to love? I want to be clear. I'm not talking about jealous behavior. I think we can all agree, jealousy is not a pleasant experience. And I think jealousy can be traced to a lot of very harmful, tragic behaviors. Abuse, betrayal, abandonment, harm. I mean, you name it. Esther Perel goes on to describe there's a difference between jealousy and envy. Jealousy fears what it might lose. Envy fears what it may not have. I've done a lot of reflecting. Sociologists say that jealousy is a very complex emotion that isn't experienced until about 18 months of life, 18 months to 2 years, as a human being develops a sense of self. And when I think of my experience of jealousy, I can trace it back to that time in my life. I was the firstborn son on both my grandparents' side. And I take that back. I was the secondborn on my grandmother's side. But there was no mistake when I was a little boy that Jimmy, as they called me, was the favorite. My mom's brother, who's still alive, lives in Arizona. I saw him a few months ago. He's got dementia. But every time I see him, he goes, "Yeah, Jimmy, you were mom's favorite." And I remember as a little kid walking home from school in Greendale, Wisconsin. Reminds me a lot of Coeur d'Alene, a lot of coming back here. It's kind of like coming back to my childhood. And I would stop off at my grandma's house, and she'd be baking apple pies, and I'd walk in and sit next to her, and she'd give me little apples with cinnamon and sugar on them, and little pieces of pie crust with cinnamon, and cooked them, and all that kind of stuff. And then yeah, she'd grab my little cheek and say, "Jimmy, I love you so much." You know? And the grandmother, my dad's mom, she's also passed away. I felt her specialness toward me later in life. If she were here today, she had dementia too, say, "Oh, this is Jimmy. He's a minister." She liked the fact that I'm a minister because she's very Catholic. And see, in Catholic families, the firstborn sons go on to be priests. So I didn't make it as a priest in the Catholic Church, you know, but she always said with, "Oh yeah, this is Jimmy, a minister," you know. But the point is, as a child, I grew up in that ecology of feeling chosen, feeling special, feeling someone's number one. Oddly, when my brother was born, I started to have an experience of jealousy. When my grandparents, my mom and dad, starting to show love to him, I didn't know it at the time, but I was afraid. How can, wait, no, you can't love him. You have to love me. You can't, this doesn't make sense. And my brother and I, growing up, we have a great relationship today, but I mean, we were at odds with each other, and I can't speak for him, but I can tell you, we were always in competition with each other because I was jealous. I was jealous. When I was 8 years old, my parents divorced, and my mom left the family. She was in love with another man, was going to go marry him, and she didn't leave us as kids, but you know, she left the family. And again, subconsciously, there was this sense of, you know, something's lost. I'm not under that. And now as I've continued on through my adult life, jealousy, insecurity shows up in many ways, not just in relationships, but in career, in job. You know, Dennis Ashley, you know, it's like, "I like you and I'm a little afraid of you," you know. And what I begin to understand is that in so many cases, I think jealousy comes from this need to feel chosen, to feel special, to feel loved. And what if experiences of jealousy that we have can be a portal to not project that feeling onto someone or something else, but allow it to become a portal back to yourself and to God? So I had a great time taking my little boy, Jimmy, up skiing yesterday. We had a blast. He loves the mountains and everything, okay? But see, here's the point. I meet some people, you know, I take jealousy and I bury it in the backyard, okay? With all the love and compassion I have, I'll tell you, that's denial and spiritual bypassing. If you can find a way to see your experience and to start with holding it and meeting it in your own heart with love, compassion, and kindness, it can lead you into a deeper experience of loving God and therefore loving yourself with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and then expressing that love to others. If there's anything you can take away from this exploration of jealousy, is an acknowledgement that sometimes it's really, really messy. Yeah. I hope to create a community here, and I hope you receive what I'm telling you today, not from some spiritual leader or guru who's got it all figured out. I'm learning with you, and you're helping me learn. And I hope that we can design a community here that's safe enough and strong enough and loving enough to be able to meet each other where we are in our spiritual journey. This shows up in spiritual communities a lot. After Easter, I'm going to do a new class on religious recovery, and we're going to take a deep dive into that. And my intent and my hope and my wish and my aspiration is that we can be a community here that's strong enough to love each other, to see each other, to hold each other, myself included. I mean, I want to help you grow. You're helping me grow. Know that. and watch what can happen, to live into this beautiful, 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 colorful effervescence that we already are. So just back to this here. May we here be jealous. May we be jealous for the collective effervescence that we already are. I'd like to close with a poem, because oftentimes dealing with matters like this can lead us to a time of grief. And this is a poem by Rumi called Love Dogs that has really meant a lot to me. One night a man was crying, Allah, Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praising until a cynic said, So, I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten a response? The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep. He dreamed he saw Kidur, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Because I've never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. Amen, and so it is.
The nighttime shadows disappear. Life is a game. You can always start. start again. So don't let the sun catch you crying. Don't let the sun get you crying. Oh no.